In a world obsessed with productivity and consumption, Roman Krznarek's How Should We Live arrives as a breath of fresh air. This remarkable book has quietly become a touchstone for those seeking deeper meaning in their lives, with celebrities from Emma Watson to Russell Brand citing its influence on their personal philosophies. What makes this work particularly powerful is how it bypasses the typical self-help formula, instead mining 3 millennia of human experience for practical wisdom about life's fundamental questions. As Krznarek puts it, history is a wonder box of insights waiting to be opened. The book's approach has sparked reading groups across university campuses and corporate boardrooms alike, with its central premise that we can find guidance for modern dilemmas by examining how people lived in other times and places, resonating deeply in our rapidly changing world. The ancient Greeks understood love with a sophistication that makes our modern conception seem impoverished by comparison. While we fixate on romantic love, they recognize 6 distinct varieties, each serving different purposes in human connection. Eros, sexual passion, could possess one completely. Think of Pericles abandoning his wife for Aspasia, or Zeus transforming into various creatures to seduce women. But the Greeks considered philia, friendship, more virtuous, existing in multiple forms, between family members, business partners, and most valuably, battlefield comrades who would risk their lives for each other without expectation of return. They also celebrated ludus, playful love, seen in flirtation and dancing, pragma, mature love that develops between long-married couples through compromise and mutual support, agape, selfless love, extended to all humanity, and philautia, self-love, which, in its positive form, enhances our capacity to love others. Understanding these varieties allows us to recognize love's presence throughout our lives rather than seeking it all from one person. Our modern obsession with romantic love, the quest for a soulmate who fulfills all our emotional needs, developed over centuries through 5 key stages. It began in 10th century Persia, where tales combined erotic passion with soul fusion, establishing romantic love's core elements. This Persian passion traveled west via the Crusades and through Muslim Spain, where the Cordoban philosopher Ibn Hazm published The Ring of the Dove in 1022, describing bewildering love at first sight in terms completely recognizable today. The second stage emerged when troubadours transformed these ideas into courtly love, cortesia, elevating romantic love to a life ideal among the aristocracy. The third stage appeared in 17th century Netherlands with companionate marriage, gemeenschap, transforming marriage from a utilitarian contract into a passionate union. The fourth development was the Romantic movement, ignited by Goethe's 1774 novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, which sparked a cult of passionate, unrequited love. The final layer emerged in 20th century capitalism, when love became commodified through diamond marketing campaigns and the growing tendency for people to market themselves as objects of desire. Konstantin Brancusi's sculpture, The Kiss, symbolizes everything wrong with romantic love. Lovers locked in an embrace that eliminates individuality and independence. Instead, we should cultivate the Greek varieties of love with different people, fostering philia through friendships outside our primary relationship, seeking ludus through play beyond sex, and making space for agape by extending love to strangers. In seeking a partner, we must abandon perfectionism. No one person can satisfy all our desires for every dimension of love. The modern family faces unprecedented challenges in communication and role distribution. Parents struggle to connect with teenagers, couples spend more time watching television than talking, and domestic time inequality persists, with women doing twice as much cooking, cleaning, and childcare as men, even when both parents work full-time. Historically, Western men were more domestically engaged before industrialization. The term husband originally referred to a man bonded to his house, performing husbandry work. Pre-industrial families centered economic and domestic life around the home, with men building cradles, chopping firewood, and often caring for children. The Industrial Revolution created today's stark household inequalities by separating work from home. Men became breadwinners in factories, while women were confined to domestic duties through patriarchal ideology and the cult of true womanhood. The Aka Pygmies of the Western Congo Basin offer a striking alternative model. Aka men spend 47% of each day holding or within arm's reach of their children, participating in almost all childcare tasks, even comforting crying babies at night by offering their nipples to suck. This involvement stems partly from their year-round family net hunting, where fathers carry babies over long distances. Family conversation, true dialogue that creates mutual understanding, remains underdeveloped in most households. The dinner table often becomes a conversational battlefield of tensions, secrets, and silences. Three historical barriers have impeded meaningful family conversation: segregation, silence, and emotional repression. In ancient Greece, where Socrates pioneered philosophical conversation, women were excluded from the male symposium. Throughout European history, segregated dining was common. Men ate separately from women and children. Silence was another barrier, especially in peasant households and religious traditions. These historical patterns help explain why genuine family conversation remains challenging even today. Empathy. The art of stepping into another's shoes to see the world from their perspective is fundamental to meaningful human connection. Unlike sympathy, it requires imaginatively transporting oneself into another's character and reality. This cognitive empathy comes naturally to us, helping us understand others' sorrows and joys while prompting compassionate action. Despite newspapers constantly depicting humans as aggressive and cruel, there's an alternative narrative. We are homo empathicus, with an innate capacity for empathy alongside our selfish drives. While Thomas Hobbes popularized the dark view that humans are self-interested creatures requiring authoritarian control, Adam Smith argued in his largely forgotten Theory of Moral Sentiments that we naturally empathize with others' suffering through our imaginative capacity to change places with them. Modern psychology, evolutionary biology, and neuroscience confirm this empathic nature. The remarkable story of C.P. Ellis, a poor white man who rose to become exalted Cyclops of Durham's KKK chapter, illustrates empathy's transformative power. When appointed to co-chair a racial committee with black civil rights activist Ann Atwater in 1971, their conversations revealed shared struggles. Both were poor, both had children being mocked at school. This conversational revolution exploded his prejudices, leading him to tear up his Klan card and become a civil rights campaigner. Their friendship lasted decades, with Ann regularly visiting CP when he developed Alzheimer's until his death in 2005. Beyond conversation, challenging ourselves with new experiences offers a more demanding but potentially more rewarding approach to expanding empathy. George Orwell transformed experiential empathy into an extreme sport. After his privileged upbringing and service as a colonial police officer in Burma, Orwell conducted radical experiments in experiencing poverty. He dressed as a tramp, frequented homeless hostels, and wandered London's East End streets with beggars. While acknowledging he only saw the fringes of poverty, these experiences fundamentally changed his worldview. Empathy can transcend individual interactions to become a mass phenomenon, driving fundamental social change. The British struggle against slavery in the late 18th century exemplifies how collective empathy for strangers can bridge social divides. Factory workers saw similarities between their exploitation and that of slaves, marching under banners calling for ending slavery both at home and abroad. This mass empathic movement rewrote history, demonstrating empathy's power in shifting historical course. Discovering ourselves requires more than narcissist-like introspection. We need an outrospective attitude that steps outside ourselves to understand how others think and live. Eventually, we begin seeing not just individuals, but the relationships between them, noticing where empathic bonds are strong or remain latent. our vision fills with invisible threads of human connection that hold the world together in a tapestry of mutual understanding. Adam Smith, ironically celebrated on the British 20-pound note, bears responsibility for modern work's monotony. His advocacy for dividing complex tasks into tiny segments, illustrated by the 18 separate stages of pin-making, became capitalism's mantra but introduced soul-crushing repetition. Though Smith admitted this created torpor of the mind and loss of tender sentiment, his division of labor remains our deadening inheritance. Today's workers seek more than the drudgery Smith described, increasingly expecting work to be personally fulfilling and life-enhancing. Many attempt to find meaning through pursuing money, treating work as means to an end rather than intrinsically valuable. Yet evidence shows wealth rarely brings fulfillment. Despite rising incomes, life satisfaction remains flat in industrialized nations, with America's highest-paid professionals, lawyers, suffering depression at 3 times the average rate. 4 historical motivations guide those seeking meaningful work: being driven by values, pursuing meaningful goals, obtaining respect, and using our full array of talents. Albert Schweitzer exemplifies work driven by values. This accomplished polymath, organist, theologian, philosopher, and Bach biographer abandoned his brilliant European career at 30 to become a doctor in French Equatorial Africa, where he established a leper hospital and eventually won the Nobel Peace Prize. Medieval attitudes toward work as punishment transformed with the Protestant Reformation. Luther and Calvin elevated labor from burden to religious duty, making mundane toil into a kind of sacrament. Beyond hard work, Protestantism introduced the concept of a calling, following a vocation that contributes to public welfare. Viktor Frankl's observations in Nazi concentration camps revealed that survivors often had concrete assignments beyond mere survival, like the scientist determined to complete his unfinished books or the man living to reunite with his son. Throughout work history, recognition has rivaled money as a primary ambition. Status-based recognition often proves hollow. We may be admired for our position rather than our individuality. Over the past century, respect has emerged as a more meaningful alternative, being valued for personal contributions rather than hierarchical position. Beyond values, goals, and respect, work must allow us to explore our talents. The central question becomes, should we be specialists, high achievers, or generalists, wide achievers? The Renaissance ideal of the many-sided man offers an alternative to hyperspecialization. Leon Battista Alberti exemplified this as author, artist, architect, poet, linguist, philosopher, musician, and gymnast. Our addiction to knowing the exact time has become near universal. We glance compulsively at watches and clocks that surround us everywhere, on phones, computers, microwaves, cars, and buildings. This obsession coincides with a growing time famine in Western societies. A quarter of Americans always feel rushed, rising to over 40% for working mothers. We constantly rush to save time, but have nowhere to deposit these savings. This clock-dominated existence strains relationships, clouds judgment, and deadens our senses. Yet humanity thrived for millennia without precise time measurement. Socrates philosophized without knowing if it was 3:10. Hildegard revolutionized music without minutes or seconds. And Leonardo painted masterpieces without checking watches. This tyranny of the clock evolved from ancient civilizations' focus on seasonal calendars to medieval Europe's mechanical clocks, which revolutionized human consciousness. By the 17th century, minute hands appeared. By the 18th, seconds followed, creating a manufactured culture of chronological precision. The Industrial Revolution transformed time into a form of social control. Josiah Wedgwood introduced the first clocking-in system in 1769, with factory owners often manipulating clocks to exploit workers. Our concept of time is structured by metaphors that subtly shape our thinking. 2 dominant metaphors emerged during the Industrial Revolution: time as a commodity, spending time, saving time, time is money, and time as a possession, my time is my own. When we speak of time off from work, we're unconsciously acknowledging that employers own our time. Imagine if we reversed this language, calling vacations and weekends our time on, suggesting we own our time and merely grant portions to employers. Though most understand the virtues of slowing down, our high-velocity culture makes it extraordinarily difficult. We've developed the peculiar habit of equating busyness with success, greeting each other with, "Are you busy?" rather than, "How are you?" Practical steps toward deceleration include going on a chronological diet, abandoning your watch, turning off phone time displays, and covering digital clocks. Embrace slow time activities. Study just a few paintings at galleries. Notice daily changes in nature. Savor food flavors and plan fewer daily activities. Western culture's linear conception of time, an arrow moving from past through present into future, keeps us perpetually fluttering between yesterday and tomorrow, unable to experience the now. The Balinese Pawukon calendar presents time as interlocking wheels within wheels, creating 210-day cycles that indicate not how much time has passed, but what kind of time it is. Days are either full, significant events, or empty, nothing much happens. Time pulses rather than shoots forward, with cyclical moments more significant than linear progression. Shopping has transformed from necessity to leisure pursuit, with nearly 1 in 10 Westerners addicted to retail therapy. We forge identities through purchases, wanting to fit in yet stand out, judging ourselves through others' eyes. This consumer culture is surprisingly recent. Until the mid-18th century, consumer was a pejorative term, meaning squanderer. The rise of shopping began with changing attitudes toward wealth in early modern Europe, accelerated by Protestant ethics legitimizing business and economic theories claiming self-interest benefits society. By 1700, traditional markets gave way to permanent shops selling exotic goods, creating a culture of limitless desire, where status became fused with wealth display. The 19th-century department store revolution, exemplified by Aristide Boussicot's Bon Marché in Paris, transformed shopping into an all-embracing entertainment experience. Simple living has ancient roots across civilizations. Socrates enjoyed visiting markets to see all the things I am happy without, while Jesus warned against deceitfulness of riches. The tradition flourished in America despite its reputation for materialism. Transcendentalist Henry David Thoreau spent 2 years in a self-built cabin at Walden Pond, growing his own food while working minimally. His innovation was showing simple living as uplifting rather than austere, demonstrating that a man is rich in proportion to the number of things which he can afford to let alone. The modern voluntary simplicity movement continues this tradition, seeking lives outwardly simple, inwardly rich. Practical approaches include buying secondhand, growing food, making furniture, using free resources, living in smaller homes, and working fewer hours, all while asking, what's the minimum I need, rather than how much can I earn? Simple living also embraces community life as an antidote to possessive individualism. Activities like babysitting circles, car sharing clubs, time bartering networks, and volunteering create fulfilling social bonds without requiring money. Travel offers us the opportunity to transform ourselves, not merely escape routine. This tension between meaningful journeying and commercial tourism began with Thomas Cook himself, who pioneered mass tourism in 1841 not as a profit venture, but as a mission to broaden minds through cultural encounters. His first trip took 500 working-class people by train to a temperance meeting, and he later organized affordable European tours for laborers and clerks to foster universal brotherhood. The pilgrimage tradition suggests we shouldn't obsess about destinations, but value the journey itself. Basho would advise travelers to avoid planning routes too carefully, even throwing away maps to permit getting lost, the best way to find oneself. Using senses as a compass, following curious smells or sounds, and embracing serendipity can transform travel into an end in itself. The modern tourist's obsession with famous artworks and monuments stems from the aristocratic Grand Tour tradition, which Carl Baedeker's influential 19th-century guidebooks democratized for the middle class. Baedeker created an enduring tourism ideology with his star rating system, detailed architectural measurements, and rigid itineraries that exhausted travelers rushing from site to site. We should reinvent tourism by recognizing that the real monuments worth visiting are people, as explorer Wilfred Thesiger noted. The romantic notion that humans are essentially nomads who find wholeness only through movement appeals to our restless spirits. Bruce Chatwin argued that our nomadic hunter-gatherer past of millions of years makes our recent 10,000 years of sedentary living unnatural. Camping offers a more accessible taste of nomadic experience, living outdoors in temporary shelters, relying on fire, and embracing simpler living. Beyond pilgrim, tourist, or nomad lies another traveler archetype, the explorer. Mary Kingsley stands as a remarkable example, an uneducated Victorian woman who traveled alone through West Africa in the 1890s, discovering fish species and challenging racial prejudices of her time. Though she began with conventional Victorian beliefs about African inferiority, her direct experiences led her to defend African sense of justice, honor, rhetorical skills, and good temper. True exploration means venturing beyond prejudice and assumption rather than merely pushing geographic frontiers. While lifestyle obsessions fill magazine pages, we should engage more deeply with death style, the art of growing old, facing mortality, and dying well. This requires a culture that discusses death openly. Death has become increasingly distant from Western minds due to unprecedented longevity increases and its disappearance from public life. The medicalization of death, erosion of funeral rituals, and death becoming a conversational taboo have pushed mortality into an almost unreal future place. Medieval Europeans lived intimately with death in ways unimaginable today. The Danse Macabre, Dance of Death, depicted people from all social stations dancing with skeletons, reminding viewers that death was always near and made everyone equal. This morbid fascination wasn't mere curiosity, but contained a crucial message. Medieval people had a heightened appreciation for life's preciousness and fragility. Historian Philippe Ares concluded that, probably at no time has man so loved life as he did at the end of the Middle Ages. The constant reminder of death propelled people toward radical aliveness. The decline of communal death rituals has robbed us of opportunities to think about, talk about, and come to terms with death. We've created silences where none need exist. Exercising death from daily life has exacerbated our fears and damaged our capacity to grieve. There are now few chances to publicly express feelings about losing loved ones, making grief a social embarrassment. Death hasn't completely vanished from public life, as vibrant Irish funerals demonstrate. In Mexico, death remains central to cultural identity, with the Day of the Dead celebrations featuring skull toys, sugar skulls, dead bread, and cemetery vigils. These traditions blend indigenous death practices with Spanish imports like the medieval Dance of Death. From these traditions, we can learn to invent our own death rituals and find new ways to discuss mortality. When the author's grandfather Leo was moved from his beloved wilderness home to a nursing home after his 90th birthday, he lost everything that defined him: his home among nature, his books, his typewriter, even his preferred name. Within 6 months, he was dead. Nursing homes represent one of modern civilization's greatest scandals, places where the elderly are put out of sight and out of mind. The Confucian concept of filial piety offers an alternative model. In China and Japan, where this principle of children caring for aging parents remains strong, 40-60% of elderly people live with their children, compared to just 5% in Western nations. The author concludes with Johann Wolfgang von Goethe's dramatic midlife crisis at age 37, a pivotal moment that would reshape one of literature's greatest figures. Despite achieving early literary fame with The Sorrows of Young Werther, Goethe found himself trapped in a suffocating routine. His creative work had stalled, his government position in Weimar had become tedious, and his complicated relationship with Charlotte von Stein remained painfully unresolved. His solution was radical and would have seemed unthinkable to his contemporaries. In the dead of night, he fled to Italy under the assumed name of Johann Philipp Möller, carrying only two small bags and leaving behind his prestigious position, wealth, and social standing. This secret departure launched a transformative two-year journey through Italy that would profoundly reshape both his artistic vision and personal identity. In Rome, Florence, and Naples, Goethe immersed himself in art, architecture, and classical culture, sketching ruins, studying botany, and rediscovering his passion for creative work. This period of self-imposed exile produced not only renewed creative energy, but also resulted in masterworks like Roman Elegies and Iphigenia in Tauris, while laying the groundwork for Faust, his crowning achievement. Goethe's dramatic break from convention offers powerful lessons for anyone contemplating significant life changes. While many of us can recognize our challenges, whether in careers, relationships, or creative pursuits, moving from awareness to action remains daunting. We become trapped in golden handcuffs, comfortable routines, and social expectations. Goethe's seemingly reckless departure demonstrates that sometimes radical action is necessary to break free from stagnation. This might mean resigning from a well-paid but soul-crushing job, leaving a toxic relationship, or choosing to live contrary to societal norms, perhaps embracing minimalism in an age of consumption, or pursuing art in a culture that values only profit. Goethe's philosophy suggested that true self-understanding comes not through endless introspection, but through what might be called outsprechen, active engagement with the world, new experiences, and different perspectives. His ultimate message resonates across centuries. At some critical point, we must stop merely thinking and take decisive action. Carpe diem, a leap of faith, just do it. When facing our own crossroads or moments of hesitation, we might productively ask ourselves, what bold move would Goethe make in our situation? Two golden threads emerge from this historical exploration of how to live authentically. First, that life's deepest meaning emerges primarily through our relationships and connections with others, not through solitary achievement or accumulation. Second, that giving and being of service are essential to finding lasting fulfillment. As Goethe himself poignantly asked, "What is my life if I am no longer useful to others?" The civilizations and lives of the past reveal that our current ways of loving, working, creating, and even approaching death are not our only options. We need only open the wonder box of history to discover new possibilities for living. Goethe's radical reinvention stands as testament to the transformative power of courage and the rewards that await those willing to take that crucial leap into the unknown.